Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 2:42 p.m. on March 24th, 2009. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Huggins, and Senator Thomas, and myself, Senator Stedman. We have one presentation on the agenda this afternoon. On February 25th, the EPA released a report on the cruise ship plume dilution study conducted in Skagway last July. And I've asked representatives from the EPA and DEC and the cruise ship industry to come before the committee today to discuss the results of the study. This meeting is by invitation only. We will not be taking public testimony at this time. We will have the EPA up first. Second, we will have a discussion with DEC, and we'll wrap up the meeting with Mr. John Binkley, representing the cruise ship industry. Mr. Brian Rapoli, the primary EPA contact for this report, is online from Washington, D.C. And I want to advise the committee that Mr. Rapoli has agreed to participate today and answer questions regarding the technical aspects of the report. He is not here to debate the political aspects of the cruise ship discharge. And please keep your questions to Mr. Rapoli limited to the methodology and the science behind the report. With that, I'd like to invite Mr. Rapoli to introduce himself and who he represents and give the committee a brief overview of the EPA report. And I think each committee member has that in front of them. Mr. Rapoli.
Hi, thank you very much for the introduction. Brian Rapoli, I am with the Ocean and Coastal Protection Division in the Office of Water from EPA headquartered at Washington, D.C. I understand that you would like a very brief overview of the study, and I'm prepared to give you just that. If any point during my description, if there are any questions, or if I use something that seems like a jargon term and you would like me to amplify what that means, just please interrupt me and let me know. And with that, I guess I could begin.
We'll try to keep the interruptions to a minimum because it's difficult when you're online so far away. So if you could just walk us through the report, and then at the end we'll clear up any confusion the members may have.
First, I'd like to point out that this was a collaborative effort. Work was done jointly with EPA's Office of Water and the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. And we certainly owe a great debt of gratitude to the folks from DEC that helped us with many technical aspects of the, from the performance of the study to the preparation of the report. Additionally, some other words of thanks are due to the members of this committee, because I understand that you were responsible for supplying the funds that help underwrite the study, and I'd like to thank you for that. And also, I would like to just a few words of thanks to the owners and operators of the Carnival, Norwegian, and Royal Caribbean vessels that were willing to participate in the study. Study could not have taken place without their cooperation. I'd like to give you just a very brief description of the study. As you know, we were looking at discharges from cruise ships to supply information to both EPA and DEC, so we had a better understanding of how the discharge plumes dilute in close proximity to the vessel, so that what we were oftentimes referring to as near-field dilution. This was accomplished using a combination of equipment that was installed aboard the cruise line vessels and equipment that was external to the vessels on a small boat operated by EPA craft, sometimes manned by EPA and the DEC members of our sampling team. The equipment aboard the ship, the most important part of that was a precision metering system, which supplied a very accurately known amount of a rhodamine dye that that was pumped into the discharge lines of the advanced treatment systems aboard the vessels. This was done well upstream of the discharge port to ensure very good mixing of the dye with the treated discharge water. And then downstream of that, we also had another instrument, a fluorimeter, which was specifically used to measure the dye's concentration prior to leaving the ship. This was to give us a fail-safe so that we had very good accuracy in terms of what the concentration of the dye was before it ever left the ship, so that we could then subsequently determine the solution as it moved away from the vessel. The small boat that our sampling crew was on, we had predetermined a set of transects that the ship would operate on, the boat. And during those transects, it was towing an instrument package. It carried some rather traditional equipment that measured parameters such as temperature, depth, and salinity. And these are, you know, normal characteristics one measure for something like this to understand density and temperature gradients in the water column. But the real heart of the system was a portable fluorimeter that was, again, we specifically equipped the instrument so that it would be tailored to measure the rhodamine in the water column using, you know, the correct set of filters and excitation lamps. This was a very sensitive instrument, and that's important for two reasons. We wanted to use the absolute minimum amount of dye, no reason to add something to the water column when it's not necessary, but yet we were still able to get very, very high sensitivity from the instrument, able to record the dye in the water column in the part per billion range. So it's a, you know, very nice, very sensitive instrument. The advantage of this system is that all of the data is being collected right then, right there in the field. There's no reason to collect samples, package them up, and send them away for any subsequent analysis. So all the data was collected in real time and recorded on actually a laptop PC, and then brought back to the bold on a regular basis and downloaded there. That's sort of the basis of the experiment and how it was conducted. Is there any questions that you gentlemen might have? Anything I might clarify before I move on?
Nope. Go ahead and continue on.
Okay. Just a couple of statements about the purpose of the study. Be a little redundant. It was to inform both of our agencies, that is EPA and DEC, give us a better understanding of how cruise ship discharges would dilute in a receiving body. And we specifically chose Skagway in consultation with DEC because we're trying to look at a water body that had relatively low flushing. And Skagway certainly fit the bill compared to some of the other possibilities that we had available to us. The information that we collected was then going to be used by DEC in its subsequent analysis. And if I could, just a few words about the purpose of the sampling episode report. The major purpose, obviously, is to present, you know, a very large volume of raw data. We feel it's very important that the information be made publicly available. That's why we published it early and made it available on our website. We provided a very brief and very simple narrative description of the text, of the data. I think in total there might have been about 2 pages of description of the data, when the data actually occupies about 1,400 pages of the appendices. So I say that just to give you some idea that this was only a very cursory description of the data set. The data was collected with the intention for use by DEC in hydrodynamic modeling. I would like to make it clear that the report in and of itself is not in any way or not should be not considered a rigorous technical analysis. That true technical analysis is being done by DEC. This is simply a narrative description of a very large data set. Is there anything more you would like me to say unless you have specific questions?
No, we have no questions. Are you finished?
That was all I understood. I was requested to provide a very brief overview. I hope that satisfied your needs. If not, please let me know and I could try to provide some additional information.
Okay, and then Laura Johnson, are you online? Laura Johnson, the EPA. Okay, well, I guess we'll go on.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah. Mr. Rapoli, can you hear me okay? Yes, it's Charlie Huggins here from Wasilla, Alaska. As I look through your study and your plumes, it appeared that, you know, from 250 to 270 and some variances of that, you talked about the dye proliferation and the dilution. Are there any additional insights you can give us to your dye calculation and the experiment conclusions overall?
No, sir. That was not something that EPA had ever intended to do as any type of true hydrodynamic analysis. I'm sure you're aware that plumes are, you know, spatially and temporally highly variable depending upon a very wide set of parameters. And these descriptions are typically done using computational models such as CoreMix or plumes, visual plumes, CH3D. There's quite a few of them that are being used in academic and regulatory circles. That part of the analysis is going to be done by DEC. That's my understanding. It was not something that EPA has conducted.
Okay, thank you very much.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rapoli, I appreciate your study, and not being an expert in what I'm seeing here, I understand that having worked with spectrometers, not fluorometers necessarily, I was wondering what kind of correlation there was when you're dealing with a dye, which is a specific molecular weight and a smaller molecule, than when you're dealing with something like an organism like coliform bacteria that are in the sewage, in the sewer water, and even the gray water for that matter, where you're dealing with more microbes that are not just molecules, but they're, and would have a different settling component and a coefficient of spreadation throughout the water. How do you correlate those two?
That's a very good question, very insightful question. Thank you for that. If I may, to start with, and if I go off track and I'm not addressing it, please redirect me. You're correct. The rhodamine dye that we use is a relatively large molecule. However, it is miscible with water, and we had no reason to believe that it would dilute anything other than in a conservative fashion. So we assume it remained homogeneous and would not in any way associate or use some type of physical removal from the water column. This dye has been used for any number of years. I would hesitate to tell you how long it's been used in water-like experiments, everything from looking for leaks in water delivery systems to oceanographic studies. I know of no instances where there have been problems. There's a possibility there may be an issue like that, but I am unaware of any. To address your other question in terms of how this might behave, if I'm getting the question correctly, relative to not a chemical molecule, but rather a small microbe, I believe that considering the kinetic energy in the plume in this proximity is so high that we're unlikely to see gravitational effects due to the small differential in density and buoyancy that a microbe might have. I think we would have to start getting to rather larger particulates before we saw anything really showing a significant effect. Not something that could be answered definitively without some type of sensitivity study, but I'm not sure exactly if there is an issue here, and I apologize for perhaps asking a question of you. I believe that these systems have very low fecal coliform release rates. So is there truly something of concern here that you feel we need to address?
I was not looking at it from that standpoint. I was just looking at it from the standpoint of the validity of the study related to issues such as disease. Since I'm a medical doctor, obviously these things are forefront on my mind.
So I think within the proximity of the vessel where we were working, the plumes, the kinetic energy has not dissipated, so that we're really not seeing other effects really start having significant contributions. I think perhaps Jim Gendron from DEC might be better posed to answer this question, to be honest, because Jim, I understand, has been doing some computational analysis, and I would certainly, bow to his more, recent work in the field and also better, higher level of familiarity with the subject matter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Do anybody have any other questions for Mr. Rapoli? Okay, thank you, Mr. Rapoli, for taking the time out of your busy day back in the Southern 48 and calling into Alaska. Now, we're now going to have the Department of Environmental Conservation come forward. We have representation with him. We have go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and then go ahead and address the, I guess you guys have your study and how they interplay.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Lynn Kent. I'm the Director for the Water Division at Department of Environmental Conservation. I'll start out with just a little bit of background. The legislature, of course, appropriated capital money to DEC last year to fund this study, and the language from the appropriation was to study the effect of providing for dilution of effluent from cruise ships. And as Mr. Rapoli mentioned, we did partner with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. He mentioned their research vessel, the BOLD, which served as the mothership for the studies that were conducted. We continue to work with EPA to characterize the results of the experiment. So EPA had a set role in terms of the work that they would conduct and the report that they would rewrite, and DEC has some additional goals with using the data to do things like validate computer modeling of how plumes behave in the water, and that work is underway. In terms of reports, we did provide a preliminary report to the legislature in January. It was in the form of a letter. EPA has since published their report, and we've provided the committee today with a draft companion report titled An Assessment of the Cruise Ship Plume Dilution Study Performed in Skagway, Alaska, July 2008. As Mr. Rapoli mentioned, our report, just like the EPA report, is synthesizing a huge volume of data, and we are, in our report, crunching that data in some different ways than EPA did, and that's for to meet specific requirements here in Alaska and the information that we need to determine how these plumes behave and how we regulate them. I have with me today Denise Koch. Denise is the division's cruise ship program manager. She's going to describe the study, hopefully with not too much redundancy with what Mr. Rapoli told you, and she'll summarize the findings for you. Denise has a Master's of Science in Public Health from the University of Washington. We also have here today, if there are detailed technical questions about the study design, about the equipment that was used, about the data compilation, we have our lead scientist available, Jim Gendron. Jim actually participated in the field studies, and he's the lead author for our report. Jim is a chemist with 10 years of plume modeling experience with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and we're happy to have him working on this project with us. Denise is going to describe what we did. She'll try to paint some visual pictures for you of what was done in the field. And then she will focus on the results and compare the results with the predictions that were made by some of the computer modeling that we used to look at plume behavior. She'll compare the results with Alaska's water quality standards regulations, and then she'll also compare the results with our current cruise ship wastewater discharge permit to put it in perspective for the committee members. Okay. So with that, I will turn it over to Denise, and if we have technical questions, we may ask Jim to come to the table as well, if that's all right with the chair.
Okay, if you can go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and who you represent. And
yes, sir.
Spin us up, please.
My name is Denise Koch. I work for DEC in the Division of Water. I am the cruise ship program manager. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to address you today. I have prepared a presentation that I hope you all have a copy of that we'll walk through. So I also want to mention that DEC and EPA, we work together on this, but DEC wanted to produce a companion document that had some value, that went to look for some different conclusions, and it had a slightly different focus from what EPA was looking at. And this study does look at dilution and does calculate dilution factors. So I thought I would just right off the bat discuss what a dilution factor is and why it's important. As Brian mentioned, the researchers put a known concentration of a dye into the treated wastewater from the cruise ships that participated in the study, and then they discharged it into the receiving waters, into the environment, and then the concentration of the dye was measured in the receiving environment. So for an example of what a dilution factor would be, since I'm going to talk a lot about dilution factors in the study, is if the researchers, for example, knew that the concentration of the dye in the treated wastewater on the ship was 100, and they measured the concentration of the dye in the receiving water as 50, we would call that a dilution factor of 20. So the dilution factor, I'm moving on to the next slide, where I pose this question, why is a dilution factor important? And DEC looks at both the sample results that we get from cruise ships, from the wastewater that they're discharging. So we know the concentrations that the pollutants are in those samples. And then we also need to look at these dilution factors that I just mentioned to make sure that water quality standards aren't exceeded in the receiving water in that harbor area right outside. I also want to mention that just a word about water quality standards. The water quality standards are set in regulations. They are meant to do things like there is a specific set of water quality standards for marine waters, a different set of water quality standards for fresh water. But they both are for a marine water, for example, the water quality standards are set with the aim, for example, of protecting aquatic life. When you look at things like fecal coliforms, sir, those standards are also set. We have stringent standards that look at shellfish that is going to be consumed, so you have that in mind as well. So I was going to move on now to the next slide, where I mentioned it, the title of it is Dilution of Wastewater While the Vessel is Moving. Since last year, the legislature gave DEC the direction, you know, to go forward and to look at dilution. Did want to mention that there was a past study done on dilution. And that study looked at the dilution that cruise ship wastewater was subject to when the vessel was underway, so when it was moving. And EPA conducted that study years ago. I think it was in 2001. And DEC worked with a science advisory panel to evaluate the results of that study. and found that under kind of conservative scenario, you would expect to see a dilution factor of about 50,000. So it is a very large dilution factor that you would expect behind a moving cruise ship, and it would be almost instantaneous. It's tremendous. There's tremendous turbulent dilution behind the vessel as it's moving. So we, since that work had previously been done.
Hold a second. Senator Huggins.
Yes, Denise, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Denise Charlie Huggins from Wasilla. In parens, you have down at the bottom of your slide, 200 cubic meters per hour is the discharge volume. Could you put that in some perspective of a cruise ship discharge? Could you help us out with that?
Through the chair to Senator Huggins. Yes, sir. When we were looking at doing an analysis of this data, we tried to think of standard or typical reasonable conditions that a cruise ship would actually be discharging their wastewater while they were moving. And at that time, it was standard that cruise ships would discharge when they were 1 nautical mile from shore, when they were traveling at 6 knots. And since they were only discharging when they were underway, they weren't discharging when they were stationary. When they were in a port, they would, of course, they'd be producing wastewater, and it would get sent to a holding tank. So they would have kind of a larger volume of wastewater that was produced, and then once the ship had drawn anchor and was moving on to its next location, they would be relatively full with wastewater. They would have a large volume of wastewater that they would discharge when they were underway. And we felt that this 200 cubic meters per hour was a reasonable amount of volume that a ship would be discharging after they'd been in port and they'd been holding their discharge.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Go ahead and continue.
Thank you, sir. So in the next slide, I talk about dilution of wastewater while the vessel is stationary. And this is the study that we conducted this summer. And we did pick a location that was a conservative location, as Brian Rapoli had mentioned as well. Skagway was selected because it was a representative port. It's a port that gets lots of cruise ship traffic. But it is also a port where there's very limited water movement in that harbor relative to, say, Ketchikan or to Juneau. So we were looking at a kind of conservative, worst-case location. Moving on to the next slide. The methods used to collect dilution data for the stationary cruise ships. As Brian Rapoli mentioned, this is a near-field dilution study, and that means that we looked at the dilution very close, in very close proximity to the cruise ships. We went, after this dye was injected into the treated wastewater tanks on the cruise ship and discharged into the environment, there was a small boat that was in the harbor, in the receiving water, that was actually taking the measurements, that was measuring the dye in the water. And they were doing kind of transects in the water from anywhere from about 2.5 meters all the way out to about 15 meters. So they're doing kind of crisscrosses as they go out to this outermost 15-meter zone. We did have, I did put in parentheses because I know most of us think in terms of feet. So 15 meters, we're talking almost 50 feet. We had 6 cruise ships that participated in the study. We only got usable data from 4 because we had some kind of weather and instrument issues with the other 2. But we did have 6 ships that volunteered, and we did appreciate that. The next slide, I think I covered what was on the next slide. I wanted to ask you to forward, I guess, 2 slides. There's a picture. It's called, the title is Release of Dye from Cruise Ship and Measurements Being Taken in Receiving Waters. So I think, you know, pictures are pretty powerful. Lynn said I was going to try and paint a picture in words, and Actually, I'm going to try and just actually use a picture to show you what we did here. The cruise ship would be, the cruise ship is actually out of range, but it would be kind of at the bottom of the picture. And you may see that there's a yellow line that where the small boat that's in the harbor is connected actually to the cruise ship. It was actually connected using a magnet, and they knew how far out they were in that when they were in that receiving water in that small boat, and that's where they're taking their samples. It's a little harder to see, but there's also a shorter line from the small boat at the top down into the water. That is where the instrument was that was actually recording the concentrations of the dye. I think another powerful thing about this picture is in kind of the bottom half of the picture, you see the red, which is the rhodamine dye. And you may notice also that the dye, that plume, is a somewhat of a cohesive, kind of circular, roughly circular, or maybe oblong plume. And what was generally observed is oftentimes that plume would move cohesively away from the hull. So as it was discharged, you'd have kind of a packet of water with this dye in it, and it would get diluted as it moved out further away from the ship. Now I'm just going to talk a little bit about the results, get to maybe the meat and the more important parts. I guess now I'm the third person to say this, but it is a huge data set. We've got 1,400 pages, so we have been working closely with EPA to describe this data set and to present it in the best way. But it is a summary of a complex set, and there could be some slightly different ways that people look at it. One thing that you'll see in the next slide is I included a visual. This is something that Jim Gendron had put together, and I think it's very instructive. I call it a time-lapse plot. Maybe the way to think of it would be if we were doing a metaphor with photography, it wouldn't be a snapshot of us at this one moment in time. It would be more of those kinds of pictures where they keep the shutter open and you see the sun move across the horizon over the course of a day. So if you turn to the next page, it's entitled Norwegian Star, July 16th, 2008. And on the left-hand side, you'll see we have I wanted to give some perspective for how big actually a cruise ship is. Cruise ship would be off the scale of this page, because it would be about 320 meters. But what you see on this y-axis, so if you could imagine that zero is the discharge port. And then along the x, and then as you move forward towards positive 15, we're talking about you're moving 15 meters towards the bow. And the negative 15 is you're moving 15 meters towards the stern. And on the x-axis, as you look across, you're going from zero to this 15 meters. So that's the outermost point at which the raw data was collected. I'm going to move on to the next slide. So I want to get to this question of how do you apply these dilution results that we found to cruise ship sample data to determine where water quality standards are met in the harbor. And the water quality standards, once again, are meant to protect aquatic life and public health. It's also pertinent to know with this first bullet, the cruise ship general permit sets the effluent limits for wastewater that's being discharged from cruise ships as the water quality standards. So the water quality standards and the effluent limits are one and the same. And they need to be met in the permit at the point of discharge. We have a full data set from all the cruise ships that discharged in Alaska in 2008, not just the six that participated in this study, because those ships had to give us data as part of their permit. And we know that ships are having a difficult time meeting the stringent requirements for ammonia, copper, nickel, and zinc. They are relatively successful at meeting things, or I shouldn't say relative, they're very successful at meeting standards such as fecal coliform, for example, or pH or chlorine. The systems do very well. That's why I'm kind of focusing the rest of the discussion just on ammonia, copper, nickel, and zinc, where we know the ships are having a difficult time meeting these standards at the end of pipe. So if you move on to the next slide, it has the same header. I wanted to mention that it's a standard scientific approach to look at kind of a worst case scenario. And you first look at a worst case scenario, and if there's no problem at the worst case scenario, then you'll feel more confident about kind of extrapolating that to other cases. So for this study, the kind of our worst case scenario is Skagway is the kind of a worst case location scenario. Then we also consider the maximum concentration of these pollutants. So that's once again that full body of data from the 2008 season. We took the very highest, the maximum concentrations for ammonia, copper, nickel, and zinc that were detected from all of the ships for the entire season. And then if you look at, then you compare that with the lowest dilution factor, that is essentially your worst case scenario. So I am going to focus now on our findings, I guess in three ways. One is 2.5 meters from the ship, which is what you'll see on the next slide. Then we also looked at the outermost portion that the study collected raw data, which was 15 meters. And then I also looked at the data in terms of the interim limits that are set in our permit to try and give this study some relevance to kind of current permit conditions. So for the 2.5 meters from the ship, so we're talking about roughly 9 feet, pretty close to the hull of the vessel. We saw a range of dilution factors for the four ships. That's to be expected. Dilution factors will range somewhat from ship to ship. It will vary based upon the velocity that the wastewater is discharged, the diameter of the pipe, the shape of the discharge port. There are a number of different kind of factors that go into that cause some of this variability from ship to ship. But if you look at this worst case scenario, once again using the four, which is the least dilution, these four pollutants will all exceed water quality standards in the harbor, in that receiving water at that distance. So real close up. Then I'm moving on to the next slide. I did want to give you a sense of, well, what if we pick the best case dilution, the highest dilution, which is 12. What happens is we see that nickel and zinc would meet water quality standards at that 9-foot distance, but ammonia and copper still would not meet water quality standards. So since we determined that ammonia and copper still wouldn't meet under the full range of potentials here, ammonia and copper still might not meet water quality standards at this 2.5 meters. That's why we said, okay, well, what would happen at the furthest edge of this study location? What if we went all the way out to the 15 meters? And in this case, so I've moved on to a slide that's entitled Dilution Factor at 15 meters from the ship. And I apologize, I realize I probably should have put page numbers here. So if you look at dilution factor at 15 meters from the ship, there's again a range of dilution factors, and the worst case dilution would be a factor of 28, and the best case solution would be a dilution of 63.
So just remind me, if you could, are we doing 6 knots or are we tied to the dock?
This is, to the chair, this is all while we are stationary. So everything that I have been discussing in terms of at the 2.5 meters and at the 15 meters, the entire study that DEC worked on with EPA this summer was all while the vessel was stationary and docked.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
I had a question as to why you decided there was going to be an ammonia, copper, nickel, and zinc, realizing that ammonia is a natural byproduct of most living organisms, and yet the others are elements in the periodic table. In fact, zinc is one of those, you have zinc bars on ships to go ahead and, or any kind of steel vessel to try and cut down on the corrosion. Why did you choose those?
Through the chair to Senator Olson. This goes back to when DEC was establishing a permit for cruise ships. Mm-hmm. What we did is we looked at a body of sample data that we had. I should maybe mention that DEC has had a cruise ship program since 2001, and as part of that program, ships have been required to take samples of their wastewater effluent. So when you fast forward a little bit in time to after 2006, when law now required DEC to do a permit, we had this large body of sample data. And we compared the results of the actual sample data that we had seen to our water quality standards. And we picked the most stringent water quality standards. So for example, in a case with maybe fecal coliform, we use it as the water quality standard for someone being able to collect shellfish, that sort of thing. And we saw that ships were having a problem. They were exceeding the standards for ammonia, copper, nickel, and zinc if they were required to meet those standards right at the end of pipe. Now, in having further conversations with cruise ships about kind of the sources of these pollutants, ammonia comes from urine, and cruise ships do tremendous kind of water-saving efforts on board. Water, of course, potable water costs money. And then in terms of the copper, nickel, and zinc, we've also been working with the cruise ships to try and get a sense of where those sources are coming from. And they can come from anything from the bunkered water, so potable water that they buy in different towns. They also produce their own drinking water oftentimes using evaporators. And even that sometimes that water is very soft, and then when it travels through the piping systems of the cruise ship, it will pick up some of those metals. Did that answer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead and continue.
Okay. So just starting again at the 15 meters, since we knew that cruise ships might not be able to meet these standards for ammonia and copper, even with dilution at 2.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. Denise, I just sort of sprung a thought in my mind that sounds like my house is producing some of these same pollutants. Is that a stretch or not? I mean, you mentioned how when things were moving through the conveying system of the ship, that was part of a pollution factor. So at my house, am I doing the same thing to the water that flows through?
Through the chair to Senator Huggins. Certainly some of the... For a home, for the sewage that's coming from a home certainly will contain ammonia, might not be at the same concentration because home domestic systems, the toilet bowl has more water in it. We don't have kind of the water-saving mechanisms that a cruise ship would. In terms of the metals, even the drinking water plant that is delivering fresh drinking water from the utility to an individual's home will pick up some of these metals like copper or nickel just from the plumbing that's being delivered to your home. I think it is important to point out, to talk about a water quality standard for copper because it relates to what you're mentioning, and I think it's a little bit counterintuitive. But there are standards for the amount of copper that can be in your drinking water. We know, utilities know that they're going to pick up some copper as the water travels through the plumbing. But the level that can be safely consumed for a human being, the copper, you could have a copper of 1,300, so 1,300 parts per billion, and that's considered safe for a human. However, for when you're looking at the parameter of copper, fish are very sensitive to copper. So the water quality standard that was set to protect aquatic life is actually 3.1. So it's a really huge difference. You know, it's fine for humans to consume at over 1,000, but fish, you know, you want to be lower than 3. Did that adequately address?
It did. And just a follow-up question. Where did you say you went to school?
The University of Washington. That's where I have my master's.
Okay, thank you.
May I continue? Right. Okay. So getting back to looking at the 15 meters, because when we looked at this closer area, this 2.5 meters, we saw there may still be problems with ammonia and copper. So we went out to a further distance. Now we're at 15 meters, and we see this range of dilution factors is from anywhere from 28 being the worst case scenario, the least dilution, to the highest dilution factor of 63. So if you could go on to the next slide, please. Then once again, we kind of apply, and when I mentioned applying these standards, what I mean is we take kind of the maximum hit, the maximum concentration for a pollutant in that 2008 season, and we divide it by these dilution factors. So when you do this, and you use the best, you're dividing by this kind of best case scenario for the highest dilution, all four parameters will meet water quality standards at this 15 meters. If you want to be a little bit more conservative and you look at the worst case, so you look at the lower level of dilution at 28, you still see that ammonia and copper would still exceed water quality standards at this at 15 meters. So ammonia and copper keep kind of popping up as a little bit kind of pollutants of concern. The last way that I wanted to present this data is I wanted to just make it pertinent to the general permit that we currently have for cruise ships. So I want to mention that for these four parameters, ammonia, copper, nickel, and zinc, we knew when we wrote the permit that by setting the water quality standards at the end of pipe for these four parameters, that cruise ships would have a difficult time meeting these standards. So what we did in the permit is we have essentially two levels of standards for these parameters. We had interim limits, which are more lenient limits for these parameters that applied only for the 2008 and for the upcoming 2009 cruise ship season. Come 2010, there will be more stringent, more strict effluent limits that are exactly the water quality standards. So what DEC did is we gave the industry some time to try and move towards compliance with a stricter level of standards that they could see coming at them in 2010. So I wanted to compare our dilution factors and look at this interim limits. So if we use the same procedure, so if I looked at the interim limits that were set for those parameters in the permit, and you divide it by these dilution factors, if you divide it by the worst case dilution in that short, very close area, 2.5 meters away from the hull, they still exceed water quality standards. Then I'm moving to the next slide, and I'm almost close to finishing. Then we looked now at this 15 meters, so the further area, and we used the same procedure. And based upon the data from the four ships in this study, if one of these ships in this study had wastewater, that if their wastewater complied with the interim limits, they were in compliance, and you looked out 15 meters from the hull of that ship, we would expect them to meet water quality standards for ammonia, copper, nickel, and zinc. So that would be contingent upon, you know, these ships and making sure that they are meeting the interim limits. And I'm at my last slide, which is entitled Validation of Computer Models. One other goal that DEC had in this study is this was a great opportunity for us to use actual field data, sorry, I get excited at the scientist in me, a great, to use actual field data to validate a computer model, because we don't always have the luxury of having actual field data for every single ship. So usually, or any other facility for that matter. So oftentimes what we have to do at DEC is we rely on computer models that model the dilution that you would expect to see in the receiving water. So here we were essentially putting our models to the test. Did they work? Did they work well in this area? And we were very pleased to report that in this close proximity area, we're calling this near field dilution, that the computer models were fairly accurate at predicting the dilution factors. And in fact, the models actually estimated a lower dilution factor than was observed. And maybe the plain English way to say that is that if you relied solely on the computer models, they would be more protective, they were of the environment, than if we had just relied on the actual observed concentrations.
So if you had to compare and contrast these two reports, the one you just finished and then the EPA report, could you do that briefly?
Yes, sir, to the chair. One of the things that DEC wanted to do was the validation of these models, and that was not something that EPA was going to do in their endeavors. The other way that the DEC report diverges or tries to add value to what EPA has done is to relate these dilution factors to both Alaska's water quality standards and also to relate it to the cruise ship general permit. So that sort of analysis where we looked at, you know, we have limits in a permit and we have these interim limits. Based upon these four ships, if they were complying with those limits, would they be in compliance with water quality standards? And in this instance, the answer is yes. EPA was not planning on kind of taking those extra steps as a part of their study.
Okay. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding your dilution factor of 15 meters from the ship, under your worst case scenario, with the ammonia and copper, with the minimum dilution of 28, would these standards pass the water quality standards in Washington, Oregon, and California?
Through the chair to Senator Hoffman, I imagine that they would, but I would, in order to give you the most accurate answer, I would like to be able to get back to you. Oftentimes, what states do when they set water quality standards, many states look to EPA to set water quality standards, and then oftentimes what states do is they adopt EPA's water quality standards. So you can see similarities in water quality standards from state to state, but I would need to verify that and get back to you.
Okay, yeah, if you can get back to the committee with that answer, that'd be fine.
And the other question, Mr. Chairman, is that early on you talked about the wastewater while the vessel is moving, and Senator Huggins talked about the quantities there. The study, there was no studies at those speeds of 6 knots and discharging of 200 cubic meters per hour?
There was, in fact, through the chair to Senator Hoffman, the studies that were done for cruise ships, for wastewater that was discharged from moving cruise ships, was based on field data. In many ways, the study that I described to you today that looks at stationary ships had similar components with the study taken on ships when they were moving. For example, in that study, they used that same dye, this rhodamine dye, which they injected into the cruise ship's wastewater treatment systems and discharge that dye into the receiving waters. And there was a boat in the receiving water in the harbor actually taking these measurements. So there was field data conducted for the study where ships were moving. Is that adequate to, did I sufficiently answer the question?
Yes, and the final question that I have, Mr. Chairman, is the you referred to the minimum quality standards or the standards in 2010. Are those standards just for Alaska, or are you speaking for standards for the United States?
Through the chair to Senator Hoffman, the cruise ship general permit that I am referring to is a permit that only applies in Alaska. Alaska has the most stringent standards for cruise ship wastewater discharge in the country, and this is a state permit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, Denise, are you planning on applying these to the ferry system, Alaska State Ferry System?
Through the chair to Senator Huggins, we have the official name of our program, we're the Commercial Passenger Vessel Program, and oftentimes I'll refer to ourselves as the cruise ship program, but we do have a component where we look at smaller vessels. So we look at ferries, and we look at small cruise ships, you know, maybe Cruise West, if you're thinking about a line, that have overnight, they need to have overnight capacity for between 50 and 249 passengers. Now, the law that was passed in 2006 required DEC to write a permit for wastewater discharge for large cruise ships. The permit does not apply to these small cruise ships or to the ferries. Instead of having this particular permit, in the case of ferries and small cruise ships, we have, they do have standards that are established in our regulation for things like fecal coliform and total suspended solids and chlorine. We don't have standards for them for ammonia, copper, nickel, and zinc.
Senator Huggins?
Yeah, thank you for that, Denise. And, you know, some of my friends that I've gone fishing with kind of slip out when the tide's out onto a sandbar, and sometimes they get surprised by how quickly the water comes in. And unfortunately, I was out on the west side of Cook Inlet once upon a time, and there was a bunch of super cubs sitting out getting clams, and one of them almost didn't make it, but ended up making it by manually pulling it at above tide line. But it appears to me that when you, and please help me out if you've done that, but when you take currents and the tremendous tides we have in our area, and I've seen how the water essentially disappears, I know it's even probably greater up in Cook Inlet, what factor, or is that part of your scientific equation here, the tides and the currents?
Through the chair to Senator Huggins, when we were conducting this study, so the stationary study, the researchers also collected other data besides just the concentration of dye. They were looking at everything from weather conditions, temperature, wind speed, wind direction, looking at the tides and the currents and the speed of the tides. And those, I think the way that you see those factors come to bear in this study is when you look at the draft report. I included in this presentation today that time-lapse picture of the plume distribution from the Norwegian Star. In the draft report that we released to you today, there are pictures for all four of the cruise ships that we did this study on. And what you'll see is that the plumes don't always move in a particular orientation in all four of these pictures, and we think that part of the reason for that could be that, you know, the studies were conducted during different times, and the plume direction and the direction in which the plume moves is certainly affected by the tides and by currents.
Senator Huggins?
Yeah, thank you. And my final question for it appears to me of what I've read, I don't know anything about this. I live way up in Wasilla, and not many cruise ships stop by there, maybe one day. but in any event, it appears to me that what I read, that some of the standards that you're looking at now and in the future, it may be beyond the state of the art to meet those. But help me if I'm wrong.
Through the chair to Senator Huggins. This relates to another issue that we're working on in our commercial passenger vessel program, and that is looking at what technologies could be used to meet these very stringent standards for these four parameters that we keep talking about. And DEC worked with a contractor, Oasis Engineering, and a team of experts through them. And we actually held a technology conference in Juneau on February 18th of this year to look at different technologies. And some of what we found is that first thing we did is we looked at the cruise ships as they are today, or as they were last summer, I should say. We looked at the 2008 data. We found that cruise ships were not meeting these end-of-pipe limits for ammonia, copper, nickel, and zinc. We tried to see if there were any other vessels that had treatment systems on board that would meet these standards. We couldn't find any other vessels that had those sorts of technologies. So then the next level of inquiry that we went to is we looked at land-based systems. So we wanted to know, well, does the technology exist anywhere to meet these standards at the end of pipe? And we did find that there are land-based technologies that exist now to meet the standards for these water quality standards at the point of discharge for ammonia, copper, nickel, and zinc. Then we got into some questions about what does it take to bridge the gap? What does it take to have some technology that we know exists in a land-based system and adapt it for a marine environment? And there are a number of factors that include not only things like energy requirements and stability and safety. There's also looking at there are size issues that you need to take into consideration. So we posed a question to wastewater treatment vendors who were at the conference, and we asked them, how long, give us kind of a ballpark, do you think it takes to adapt your technology and actually have it installed on a cruise ship? And the vendors generally gave a time frame of about 1 to 2 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The land-based technology, how prevalent is that, and is it in testing stages, or it's actually fully implemented in numerous locations around the country? Or can you give us a 30-second blurb on that?
Sure. To the chair, these technologies are not kind of a standard part of a municipal sewage treatment. This is a very these are very kind of high-end technologies that might be used in for the metals, for example, if you're looking at metal plating kind of industries, or Silicon Valley, or industries where you would expect to see a lot of metals in their effluent. It's not a technology that's a standard part of a municipal wastewater treatment system.
Okay, thank you. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, well, that just brings to mind, does Juneau, the city of Juneau, does some discharging, does it meet the standards?
Through the chair to Senator Huggins. Juneau has three wastewater municipal sewage systems. Juneau meets secondary treatment standards. So Juneau sewage treatment plants are very good. They do not for the Juneau Douglas plant, for example, that is located closest to the cruise ship docks down here. They don't that per, through their permit they have no limits for these metals. And they do some periodic, so all they need to do for their permit oftentimes is they need to periodically report. So periodically they need to take a sample of their wastewater effluent limits, their wastewater effluent for, say, copper. But they don't have an effluent limit associated with that.
Senator Huggins?
Well, I don't know. In Wasilla English, do they exceed the limits that we're talking about here?
I looked at the data from the Juno Douglas plant down here. Sometimes they would exceed these water quality standards. Sometimes they would exceed these water quality standards, and sometimes they would meet them.
Thank you.
Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure I understand that the situation is, after your technology conference and your conversation with the experts, that the folks in the technology folks think that if there's a bridge period of a year or two between the state-of-the-art now and the state-of-the-art that's coming along, that the cruise ships would be able to achieve the water quality standards required by the Citizens Initiative in a relatively short period of time. That would be achievable.
Through the chair, to Senator Ellis, the vendors that were there thought that it would take them a year or two to adapt their technologies to cruise ships so that the cruise ships could meet those standards. It is important to also note that it hasn't been done yet, so I don't know if we could guarantee whether they would meet the standards. We do have cruise ships that right now are trying new technologies or are trying to maximize their existing technologies, and what they have told us is that they are more confident that they will meet the ammonia standards than the metal standards, that those are more challenging. Mm-hmm. And we'll wait for some data this year to.
Okay. Well, I guess I want to thank the DEC for holding the conference with the technology folks. It's probably pushed the conversation forward. It's potentially good news. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Mr. Binkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're out of time, but we're going to give you a few minutes anyway.
I'll talk fast. For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is John Binkley. I'm from Fairbanks, and I have the privilege of serving as president of the Alaska Cruise Association. And we want to thank you first, Mr. Chairman, and committee members for your foresight in appropriating this money so that DEC could work with the EPA this last summer to do some definitive tests on dilution. Rather than speculate what it is or use computer models, it's much better to engage science and go out in the field and actually do the testing. So thank you for that. The industry always embraces technology and science in dealing with these issues, so we fully cooperated with EPA and DEC in this test because we want to know what the facts are to make certain that the aquatic life, human health, is protected, and whatever we can do to improve our systems to meet the highest possible standards that we can achieve. It actually goes back to our participation in 1999. Some of you at this table were here when this original science panel was convened, and we, the DEC, and working with many scientists from around the Pacific Northwest, came together to look at the science on the issue of wastewater discharges from large cruise ships to do some definitive work on that. The study that Denise Koch from DEC mentioned earlier about the dilution study while the ships were underway came as a result of that study in 99 and 2000 by the science panel. So we've always endorsed that. We worked with the panel as well. And that panel came up with the recommendations that this body, legislature, adopted in 2001 as the standard for cruise ship wastewater discharges. They were the highest standard in the world. It was a very difficult level to achieve, but we were working in cooperation, the industry and science and the state regulators, and we said we can achieve that level. The industry has spent over $200 million to put these systems on board the ships that now have the best wastewater treatment systems in the state of Alaska on board cruise ships. And we meet exceedingly high levels of wastewater treatment. And I brought with me, just in case any of you haven't had an opportunity to see it, this is basically the discharge from the cruise ships. Because it meets such high levels, the ships are allowed to discharge continuously while they're underway, while they're docked, while they're in Alaska waters. There's a couple of exceptions, but otherwise they can discharge continually because it's treated to such a high level. That is the type of cooperation that we like, where industry works with the regulators to find ways to do better. And that's why we were really excited about this study in Skagway, not quite as excited maybe as Denise, but nonetheless, we appreciate that. And I think the salient point, and there's some minor differences, I've just gotten this report from DEC and I haven't had a chance to go through it, but there, whether it's the DEC report or the EPA report, I think the most important point is the paragraph right in the conclusions or the executive summary in DEC's report. And it states, based upon the data from the four ships in this study, a ship whose wastewater complies with the interim limits will meet the water quality standards at 15 meters. That, again, was the study in Skagway, where it was still calm water. That's why they chose that port. It's if you could envision this room as a swimming pool, it would be like the cruise ships discharging at that end of the swimming pool. And at that end of the swimming pool, we meet all water quality standards. And remember, as Denise Koch defined that, that's the highest level at which any aquatic life is the most sensitive to. Clams, I think she mentioned, you could raise clams at that end of the room if you were discharging wastewater into this swimming pool at this end. So it's exceedingly high levels, and that's where we're at currently. And we meet all water quality standards 15 meters away. When we're underway, as she said, immediately behind a ship, 50,000 to 1. You could not even measure any of these parameters behind the ship when it was underway. And to use their words, I think, which came from the science panel in 2000 when they did the studies in the field, it achieves those water quality standards almost instantaneously as it discharges from the ship hull. So when you're moving along at 6 knots, as this water comes out of the hull, almost instantaneously, you meet those same water quality standards where you could raise clams. So in our opinion, we're meeting an exceedingly high level already, but we're not willing to stop there. We're always willing to look at ways that we can improve. And as Denise mentioned, we're working right now with particularly on the ammonia, to see what we can do to reduce those amounts of ammonia. As was mentioned earlier, one of the reasons that the concentrations are high of ammonia is because we consume very little water. And so this is a ratio of ammonia to water. That's what they're testing. And since we use very little water, our ratios are somewhat higher than other dischargers. Now, if we cranked up our showers, took our restrictors out of our showers, if we had a bucket, a 5-gallon bucket along each alongside each head where people could pour five gallons of water in the toilets when they flushed, our concentration levels would go down because our consumption of water would go up. But water's precious commodity to us. It's expensive not only to buy from communities but to make, and it's also very expensive to treat. These systems that we've got on board that we've spent over $200 million on are very expensive systems to maintain and to operate. So the less water we're moving through those systems, the less energy we consume, the less maintenance we have on those facilities, so we try and conserve water on board the ships. And that sometimes results in a little higher concentration of ammonia than some other dischargers. I know there's a lot of ground that I could cover, but probably the most advantageous would be to answer any questions that you may have so that I can have an idea of how we can assist in better understanding some of the dilution factors and how we approach those.
Well, Mr. Binkley, when you grabbed your show-and-tell flask there, I'm just thankful that you didn't take a drink of it to show us how pure it was.
Yeah, well, I have in the past, but this is a little old. This was from last June, so okay. I like mine a little fresher.
But the old jingle that's going around this particular issue, that dilution is no solution to pollution. Can you give us a 30-second burst on your thoughts on that?
Well, I've heard that, and of course it makes a great bumper sticker. I would have a little different view of that. I think dilution really is the solution to pollution. It's certainly the way Mother Nature deals with pollution. It's sometimes difficult for us to envisioned the water bodies, because we don't live in the water bodies, but if you equate that to air quality, which we all understand very well, each of us produces carbon dioxide as we exhale. That's pollution. We certainly, it would be harmful to our health. If you put a plastic bag over our heads, you'd learn real quickly that it's potentially deadly. Yet somehow we can all be in this room, we can be exhaling, and we can be polluting at our point of discharge, not meeting air quality standards. Yet we can somehow all live and breathe, and that's because of dilution. And so that's really the way that Mother Nature deals with pollution, whether it be from us as humans in breathing, whether it be fish in the ocean that cannot meet this standard as well. They cannot meet a water quality standard at their point of discharge. They all poop in the ocean, and none of them meet that standard at their point of discharge. So Mother Nature has a way of dealing with pollution, and that is by diluting. And so it's a very valid methodology of dealing with pollution, whether it be as we breathe, whether it be vehicles that drive down the road, or power plants. That is the way that we deal with solution with dilution is with pollution is dilution. You got to say that faster five times. That's my personal view of it, and at any rate.
Any final questions, Senator Huggins?
Yeah, thank you. And hey, John, thank you very much for coming. I've heard, some of the news reports. I've read, according to which account, some combative, some not. But I guess I think the average person in Wasilla and Chugiak potentially would like to hear the characterization of the industry is working with DEC and others to solve this problem. Could you tell us how that manifests itself?
Well, the technology conference is a good example, as Denise mentioned. We worked with DEC on that technology conference. We had all of our people from our environmental departments and engineering departments that came up to Juneau for the technology conference to work with manufacturers. We purchased these systems from different manufacturers, so we've been working with the manufacturers to say, how can you achieve these higher limits? What are the technologies out there? How do they fit into the systems that we have on the ships? So we embrace that. We think that's a good thing, and that's part of DEC's mission. That's part of their responsibility, is to always look at new technologies and how do we improve, whether it be air quality or water quality, and we embrace that. I do take a little exception, or we have a little different view of what came out of that technology conference, the notion that these technologies may be there in 1 to 2 years to meet all water quality standards at the point of discharge aboard a ship is a tremendous stretch, and we did not get that out of that conference. There was one example that was used in terms of meeting these standards, but it wasn't a wastewater treatment facility discharging into a receiving body of water. It was in Orange County in California, where they're trying to find drinking water, and how can they replace water in the aquifer because they're running out of water. So they're taking existing treatment facilities that are treating wastewater, then taking that water, polishing it, refining it to where they can discharge it down into the aquifers. And they do meet those levels. But they also do it through a method called reverse osmosis, which basically rejects any molecules that have some of these constituents like copper or zinc on them from going through that. They have the reject water that they can put back in the system or discharge into a water body. We can't do that on a ship. So you have secondary problems even if you put these systems on that can discharge to a level. What do you do with the water that is accumulated with all the copper in it? You somehow have to get rid of that. And that's a whole other process, either a chemical process like they do in mining, where they use chemicals to strip the molecules of copper off the molecules of water. But then what do you do with the chemicals? What do you do with the copper? There's many complications associated with that. And that's why we like to have science involved with it as well. You know, what is the appropriate level based on science that you should treat your water to? We could treat the water all day long. We could make distilled water on board with nothing in it. You could make heavy water for nuclear facilities. You could evaporate all the water if you burn enough energy to just evaporate the water. But what makes sense from a science base to make certain that you protect the aquatic life, human health, And that, coupled with the technologies, is what the standard should be set by, in our opinion.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And we're out of time. If we have any final questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Binkley, for coming today. And to the participants, tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., operating budget, public testimony. Meeting adjourned.
Thank you.